100 days. Most of us, of course, are lucky to get a couple of weeks. But then we do not have so many promises to keep. It is now exactly, or almost exactly, 100 days since Michael Harbison was elected Lord Mayor of Adelaide. And he promised us lots of things. From not closing Victoria Square to bringing the retail zing back to the city. But mainly, he said he wanted to transform Adelaide radically, to bring about a total revolution about the way the city operates, performs and grows. I now declare the honeymoon officially over and reality in place. So how goes the plan to revitalise Adelaide to become a more prosperous and exciting city? Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Lord Mayor of Adelaide, Michael Harbison.
Thank you very much, Don. Honeymoons, well, I think my honeymoon lasted all of 20 minutes. We're actually at the this swearing-in ceremony, and I think Channel 7 driving over the Burbage Road, sorry, Sir Donald Bradman Drive Bridge, noticed a bit of blue canvas in the park lands, and immediately the story the next morning was that Harbison had moved in and was kicking people out of the park lands. So my honeymoon, I think, was briefer than most, Don, but I must begin by acknowledging the Honourable Jane Lomax-Smith, Minister for Tourism, Minister for Science, Information and Economy, Minister for Employment, Training and Further Education. Thank you very much for coming along, Minister, and continuing to be interested in local government. I would also acknowledge my fellow Mayor, John Rich of Walkerville, and say thank you to so many people from local government who are also here today. But it's also very flattering to see such great interest from the media today, and comforting to be able to speak to you for once, being confident that nothing will leave the room. I mean, people say to me, don't you get a lot of grief from the media? And my response is always, no, look, I do enjoy the company of the media and enjoy speaking to the media. It's my wife that gives me grief, not the media. And you can imagine the dinner table conversation last night after my wife read this week's Messenger. Are you here somewhere, Mike and the rest of the Messenger crowd? I'm not sure that they are, but the dinner table conversation mostly revolved around how could you spend all that money on the election campaign. But nevertheless, to the business. It is more or less 100 days, so thank you very much for the invitation. My interest in the city, we seem to have a logjam here with the machine. Thank you. About 30 years ago, when I gave up the circus business and decided I'd better start making a living, I had a small motorbike shop in Compton Street, just by the Central Market. And that was about the time that the first City of Adelaide Development Plan was created, the famous Red Book, by a committee chaired by John Roche under the mayorship of Bob Clampett. And being a young fellow in town, starting to get interested in the city, I thought that this was a pretty interesting activity, and what seemed to be coming out of it was a very good plan. In fact, I had a chat to John Roche about it on Tuesday night at the Giuliani dinner. I presume most of you went to the Giuliani dinner, where Mayor Giuliani spoke extensively on leadership, and I figured that he pretty well covered that topic, and I better come back and rewrite my speech. In fact, I felt a bit as Rudy must have felt by the time Alan Jones had finished introducing him. If you were there, Alan Jones went on for about three quarters of an hour about New York City, leaving very little left for Rudy to say. But Rudy did give us a great speech about leadership. So instead, I'm going to talk to you about 100 days of nuts and bolts. But my perspective on it, as I say, began with the City of Adelaide Development Plan in 1974, where this first City of Adelaide plan predicted a residential population of the city of 30,000 by the year 2000, and a working population revised down from the 1965 prediction of 150,000 down to 120,000. I thought it was a pretty good plan, and the city was in good hands. And I got on with my life, making a living and raising a family. But unfortunately, I think that despite a lot of people's best intentions, very little progress has really been made towards... I've still got a logjam here with the machine. Can we have the next slide? Very little progress has been made towards those targets. Today we have a residential population of 17,000, if you count the 5,000 people in hospitals and in hotels, and a workforce of 93,000. This was the poster that was put out for the public consultation at the time of the John Roche plan, and it's interesting how it perhaps still resonates today when we think about the city. And I guess this was the appeal for me. No, sorry, can we go back? We're going to struggle here, I can see. This is why I felt it necessary after, I guess, 30 years of not being involved in the governance of our society, to start putting my shoulder to the wheel to see whether I couldn't make a difference to try and get our city on track. I mean, I have four children on the brink of adulthood, and I think it's pretty important to me that the city of Adelaide actually offers to them the sort of excitement and opportunity that I felt. I mean, I was very excited starting business in 1974 in Adelaide. You know, I really had a lot of fun, and I guess I grew into sort of a career of turnaround management, and that's the opportunity that I see for our city. Can we have the next slide, please? In the business of turnaround management, if you read all of the textbooks, the sort of school of thought that I tend to follow is that, it's a bit like what they say in aviation. If you're in trouble in aviation and your plane is spiraling towards the ground, you have three steps that you take. It's aviate, navigate, communicate. First, get your craft on the straight and level. Then get back and look at your charts and work out where you are. And then get on the radio and tell people where you're going. And I see fixing an organization or a business as being a little similar to that. You need to first fix your immediate problems that are putting your ship or your organization at risk. And generally in a business that's cash flow. In an organization it's often different things. Then you need to start doing your homework to get the facts, to work out where you sit in the landscape and what's going on outside your industry or outside your business and what's going on inside your business, and work out, plot your course as to where you're going. And then you have to get on the radio and tell people where you're going. You need to get out there and articulate the vision. So I guess that's my approach to organisations in a nutshell. And on gaining office in the city of Adelaide, can we have the next slide, please? Certainly we had plenty of short-term problems. We'd recently seem to have quietly gone on a course of selling our car parks, which I was concerned was contrary to the 1974 strategy and the off-street parking strategy avowed during Jane Lomax Smith's term in 1999, yeah, Jane Lomax Smith's term, that we should manage our own car parks in order that we can control the way in which vehicles use the city. So very quickly I wanted to reverse what I saw as a trend of the selling off of our future car park sites and the existing car parks. I wanted to move quickly to control the burgeoning debt. To Mayor Lomax Smith's, Lord Mayor Lomax Smith's enormous credit, we had been put on a course where we should have been debt-free, I think, by the end of next year. And instead, at the moment, our debt stands at $20 million, and in the predictions passed last year, we would have been at $43 million by the end of this financial year. Nothing wrong with debt, but you need to make sure that your capital's being used productively and that you do know your course to repayment. So it was very important that we introduced debt controls again straight away. We also needed to pass the budget, $138 million budget, that would keep the necessary capital works projects on track for asset maintenance. Also a very good program that was set in place by Jude Munro and being dangerously whittled away. And at the same time, not lose the strength of the North Terrace vision, which once again, I'm afraid I have to take my hat off to Jane Lomax Smith, a vision and plan that was signed during Jane Lomax Smith's term, and yet during the last 3 years, we'd actually failed to turn the sod. And it was very important that we made sure that that first sod was turned as quickly as possible and that that was provided for in the budget. And we did pass that $138 million budget fairly quickly. I also moved to keep Victoria Square open because whatever you think of the ins and the outs of that argument, I think it was very important that that uncertainty was resolved as quickly as possible. I brought in rate concessions that, despite what I think is a very sensible reform by the state government, continued to maintain residential rate concessions and, in fact, extended them to residential investors as well, while at the same time holding the 12.3 rate percent in the dollar for commercial tenancies. We also moved to protect the tenancy mix of the central market. I think the understanding of the importance of the fruit and produce character of the central market as an anchor to the prosperity of the rest of the rest of the precinct was being undermined and in danger of being lost, and I was very pleased that we could quickly reintroduce that rule that said it could not slip below 30%. I guess we're confronted with a couple of unforeseen hurdles. The horse trials, I understand the government's sentiment regarding horse trials. I think their analysis is quite sound, but from a city's point of view, it was terribly important to me that we didn't lose the horse trials. And so I worked with people from the previous private sector board to try and help them put in place a new board to run the horse trials in the future and work behind the scenes to twist the arms of some corporate heavy hitters in the city to get increased sponsorship for the horse trials. And I'm very pleased and grateful that the minister has in fact given us another year there to make sure that that structure is in place and the horse trials will continue. There was more to come, however. We were hit by a bus strike, but to the enormous credit of the council administration, we didn't just stand by and watch it happen. We very quickly put in place a free park and ride service. We rejigged the way we managed the car parks. We spent a lot of money on radio and newspaper advertising to make sure that people didn't get the impression that the city would be closed for business. And in fact, rather, we saw a 50% increase in the pedestrians in Rundle Mall at 7 a.m. in the morning on that the first day, and by the end of the day our pedestrian figures were actually 10% up on the previous week. So, as I say, to the credit of the council staff, the public accepted the measures that we put in place. They had the confidence to come and be part of the city and in fact joined in the life in the city in an extended way, which was all to everyone's good. But that wasn't the end of it. We discovered the Torrens Lake one morning covered with a foul diesel oil slick. But once again, the council staff came to the rescue and worked round the clock in a way I think that's really inspired the city to protect that beautiful asset, that that lake in the centre of the city. Regrettably, there was a second oil spill, but we're still discussing that one with the government. But I would hope that we would see a good outcome in the long term from that as well. The government also had determined that it would possibly take the management of the parklands from the council, and this was another short-term crisis, and it was important to me that we engage strongly but constructively with the government so that we actually found parkland solutions that were in the best interests of the community and of the city itself. And to that end, I established a parklands management committee to develop and recommend the funding priorities for the parklands, to endorse and monitor an annual business plan, to receive quarterly reports on its progress and achievements, and to liaise with the state government to promote supportive legislation and policy. I believe it was vitally important that the council have its own house in order in readiness for future legislation. I think the criticisms or concerns that the government had about the parklands management were quite legitimate, and I think it was important that rather than simply argue against them, we actually start to show the government that we could do a good job in looking after the parklands. Next slide. Additionally, the government said it would stand by the former government's commitment to close down our Wingfield dump by the end of 2004. Jane Lomax-Smith's administration had sensibly provided for this closure by rejigging the operating budget projected over the next few years, but that rejig had been steadily whittled away to the point where it was my feeling that we really had no sensible plan to deal with the loss of bottom line income that's about to hit us at the end of 2004. Now, that bottom line income has whittled itself down to $7 million a year, but it's still a pretty hard blow to our bottom line and would, unless dealt with, severely constrain our ability to run the city well. Very quickly, the council administration have worked with the government on a new proposal for the use of Wingfield, not that it become simply a great green grassy mound, but rather it become the Worm, the Wingfield Eco Resource Management Centre, as shown in this plan. The land is hopefully to be rezoned to accommodate the Worm, which will be consistent with the government's zero waste policy. And this Worm will deal with, on behalf of the whole metropolitan area, resource recovery, waste transfer, high-quality recyclables, and will give this council an income of $3 million and rising over the next few years. And I would be reasonably hopeful that it has the ability to replace the income that we now get from Wingfield, although it's my personal view that we should be out of this business. I think it's a great business, but we really have no business being in it. It's a distraction from the objectives that we have. So if anyone has an interest, we're always happy to receive your offers. But while we have its custody, I think it is very important that it's run in the best interests of the greater South Australian community. And I think that the Worm proposal is an excellent proposal, and I guess there are people on the council staff who can tell you more about that if you want to discuss it with them. But having made the ship safe, the next step, of course, was to get the facts, to find out really where this city was sitting in the landscape and where it really should be going. From the outside, and at the risk of being controversial, as a younger man, I felt that both state government and city council had fed this city a knuckle-headed vision of bread and circuses. And in the past few years, from the inside, I think the vision of the city has been as a well-groomed retirement village. And I don't think that either of these views of the city or the future, frankly, are tenable. Despite all the warnings, our children's heritage was being spent that they did. As councils and government, we do find ourselves burdened with debt and with very little idea, really, about where we're going. But it was plain to me, it always has been, that this city has good bones. That's always a good test for a takeover target. Look for a business that has good assets, former greatness, and a great brand name. And this city has all of that. This city has excellent bones. Colonel Light has given us, I believe, the best foundation one could possibly have for a city in the 21st century. A dense but permeable core in the middle of a great park. The perfect design for a modern city where the principal industry is knowledge, the growth industry for the 21st century. But rather than piecemeal actions, I think what we need are some real strategies to increase the number of residents, students, workers, and visitors with a focus on young people. If we're to have any hope of all, I think that our focus must be on youth. But to help us in all of this, we have been head down, tail up, doing a lot of investigation. We've carried out an extensive residential segmentation survey and a business segmentation survey, and just recently we've received our new land use survey, and as quickly as we can we've distributed copies of those to each of your tables, and I hope that you, like me, find it interesting reading. And this shows, these various studies show us what city residents and business operators like about the city, what they see as the key drivers, and what are the attractions to city living, learning, working, and playing, and so on. Analysis of the business segmentation survey we're still doing, but the residential survey certainly has shown us that people live in the city primarily because it's close to all the other things that they want to do. But encouragingly, it showed us that the people who don't live in the city, of the people who don't live in the city, 67% of those who used to are keen to come back, 46% of those people who are planning to move house would consider living in the city, and an extra 7.5% are actually right now trying to move into the city. But it also showed us things like that affordability was an obvious factor in considering moving to the city. 26% of prime prospects would be happy with multi-storey living. We've also just completed the 2002 land use survey. And this shows that for the first time, office workers now make up more than half the city's workforce. Now that sounds fairly boring, but what underlying that is the reflection that we're moving from a service economy to a knowledge economy. Also interestingly, there's a marked reduction in the number of vacant premises across almost all categories, and a solid jump in the number of premises being constructed or renovated. Our A-grade office vacancies are at an all-time low. I think we're down to something like 1% A-grade office vacancy. Is that right? That right, Grant? Another good sign that the knowledge industry is burgeoning. The number of residential premises has increased from 5,536 in 92 to 6,948 at the moment. A very encouraging sign. I remember the first reports I read from outside the council. We had over 10% vacancy in established residences in the council area. It's now down to less than 2%. Next slide, please. Some water. Pardon me. But if we're to be successful in creating a city for young people, in all of my discussions with young people, it boils down to a case of winning the battle of hearts and minds. That we have to make sure that Adelaide is the place that they want to be, as well as the place that it makes sense for them to be. And when I start to draw out what those needs are, I think it comes down to accommodation, careers, education, and excitement. Thanks. Looking first at accommodation. Interestingly, over the last 5 years, the only growth in the residential population of the city has been in the over 50s segment, predominantly in townhouses. The difficulty is that if we continue in this way, I think we're both building a polarised society between the very poor who came in the 1980s and the over 50s, the wealthy over 50s who are coming in at a rate of knots now. We're building for conflict, a society that's unlikely to be tolerant, but we're also building without any prospect of vibrancy. When you consider that we have an occupation rate of around 1.7 people per dwelling, when actually not constructing any greater residential density than was achieved by Playford's quarter-acre block. The houses and the land is much smaller, but there are many less people per dwelling. So you still end up with a suburban density, not an urban density. You're creating a suburb, not a city. But if we are to grow into the sort of vibrant city that we want, the first thing that we need is a new development plan. We have drafted such a plan, and it now sits with the state government awaiting public release. This will be the first major evolution since 1986 in the city plan, which was, of course, initially drafted in 1974. But this plan will be clear about the outcomes required of new development while encouraging design innovation to achieve those outcomes. it will more effectively promote mixed-use development, particularly by managing noise impacts. It will help prevent underutilisation of valuable and scarce city land and a gap-toothed landscape of low and high buildings by enabling denser development in suitable areas and by requiring minimum building heights. It will recognise and protect the unique character of Adelaide's important streetscapes and heritage buildings, and it will promote environmentally sustainable design techniques, including energy efficiency and water conservation. It will help the city's development assessment system operate efficiently as possible by eliminating unnecessary obstacles to development. The new plan calls for better initial planning and design by the applicant, but these factors are balanced by the plan enabling greater yields. With this plan, we're hoping to achieve the twin goals of better development and more development, which I think is absolutely vital if we're going to get to that population target of 34,000 residents. Now, recently, the government has been criticised for its decision to reduce urban sprawl by putting an urban growth boundary around the city. Well, I would like here publicly to commend the government for that decision. Every new house built on the urban fringe costs at least $25,000 in infrastructure costs. And this is before you take into account the hidden costs, such as the lost agricultural land, the increased greenhouse gas generation from long-distance commuting, and the social costs of living further from jobs and services. As we've seen in this week's press, the public purse simply cannot continue to bear these hidden costs. But the urban growth boundary will probably fail, I think, unless the government and we supporting the government provide two critical supporting policies. Firstly, sensible planning for Adelaide's commuter belt to stop leapfrog growth to the rural areas like the Mount Lofty ranges and the South Coast. Secondly, we need policies that will achieve increased residential yields within the urban growth boundary, and hence avoid the unnecessary upward pressure on the price of metropolitan housing. And it's in this second area that I think the Adelaide City Council really can help. We need to have a clearly understood policy of urban upfill, a policy that seeks to accommodate increased numbers of residents in a form and scale of development that is distinctly urban. And there I'm talking about a Parisian scale, frankly. 5 to 7 storey buildings, mixed-use development in the CBD, apartment living at the Parisian scale. Think of the benefits, though, of living in a city apartment rather than a fringe estate. City dwellers can make do with one car or no cars because all the facilities and services are right where they live. Fringe dwellers have little choice but to run two cars. City dwellers have access to educational, recreational, employment, entertainment and other services and opportunities that are second to none. Fringe dwellers have long and generally inconvenient trips to most things. And the state government saves money with every new city household by not having to fund the expensive new infrastructure on the city fringe. Every new city household means one less potential Tuscan shoebox in the inner suburbs, one less heritage streetscape ruined by piecemeal infill. And this council, I hope, stands ready to work with the state government in maximising the contribution of urban upfill, to managing the challenges of Adelaide's linear, low-density sprawl. In achieving these objectives, we've embarked on a course of site consolidation. The first significant move is the putting out of the Balfours and the Franklin Street bus station to tender. And on this site, we would hope to see upwards of 1,000 new dwellings created, bringing perhaps as many as 1,700 or 2,000 new people living to the area in the vicinity of the market. We hope to also include a new bus depot on the site. We want to bring the bus depot closer to the market so that as people arrive by bus, they'll actually spill out onto Grote Street and start to experience immediately the excitement of the city, rather than tipping out into the fairly desolate atmosphere of Franklin Street as they do now. But even more controversially, I think that young people need affordable rental housing. It's all very well to pursue home ownership. In practical terms, young people need rental housing, and it needs to be affordable. At our next council meeting, we will consider implementing this council's first rental housing scheme for young people. We've been accommodating cars profitably for years. I think we now need the courage to start accommodating young people too. This scheme, an Australian first, involves the council purchasing housing and constructing housing from the private sector and then on renting it at discounted rates to low-income city workers like young shop assistants or junior office workers. And we want to stimulate a new growth in rental housing in the city. We also need to lobby the state government to reduce the cost of housing, to eliminate the stamp duty inequity on apartment development. Presently, the problem with stamp duty in apartment construction is that you're faced with an extra cost of perhaps $5,000 because an apartment can't be sold as a house and land package, unlike a house that's being developed out in the suburbs on its own block. Consequently, stamp duty has to be paid on that development, and that adds an extra burden discriminating against apartment development. Victoria have fixed this problem, and there is no longer that inequity. I think it's important that the state government here does the same in order to foster inner city living. I think it's important also that we get fair about the treatment of the open space levy. The open space levy adds about $2,215 to the cost of every new title created. And yet, apart from the $3 million odd that was grabbed by Di Laidlaw a couple of years ago for some work on the Festival Centre, to the best of my knowledge, none of the open space levy money has ever been spent on creating open space in the city. The next slide, please. You're right, careers, that's fine, yeah. On careers, we will lobby the state government to support the city with public sector growth in the square mile by selling to the government the same benefits that we did to Optus and to BHP. A central location where people want to work, accessibility, infrastructure, a creative, happy, educated workforce, and low cost. The fact is that if you work in the city, you're more likely to stick at your job, your employer finds that you're a better employer, you're easier to access, he has a much greater pool of people to draw from, the infrastructure is there, and the reality is that the costs are low. Our new development plan will bring on the development of new A-grade office space, presently one of the tightest markets in the nation. We've just approved an 8-storey office building in Hindmarsh Square, and we're assessing the development of the advertiser site and an 18-storey development in Weymouth Street. And I hope to soon see the first major office developments in the city for over 10 years. We're also beefing up our economic development focus. We want to turn that Department of Council into one of the most important and start to target the knowledge industry, the foundation of which, unashamedly, is call centres. At their most basic, selling line ads for the advertiser, but at the pinnacle, it's radiologists, meteorologists, all capitalising on our wired city. I mean, the best example of that to me is down in Hindley Street in a business incubator that we've supported. There are a couple of radiologists who are working the night shift in a Californian hospital. And when I visited them, I said, well, you know, what are you fellows doing here in Hindley Street? Why aren't you over in California? And they said, have you seen the cost of living in California and the crime rate? Well, you know, I said, well, how can you work here in Hindley Street? And they said, it's the wired city that does it. The high bandwidth that we've created in Hindley Street makes it possible for these two Australian but American-trained radiologists to work the night shift in a Californian hospital and be paid in US dollars night shift rates. A patient comes into the emergency department in California, the x-rays are taken, they come down the wire to the boys in Hindley Street, they look at the x-ray on their screen, they give their diagnosis and send it out again back to the Californian hospital, and their paycheck comes down the wire straight into their bank account, and they're doing very nicely. It's a great opportunity for Adelaide, and it's not just the radiologists, but it's the meteorologists, even the pathologist, Jane. all capitalizing on our exquisite wired city. But let's talk about education. On education, our only growth in total terms has been in the private sector. And in fact, none of the private sector providers are even members of Education Adelaide. And in fact, despite the council pumping $1.8 million of ratepayers' funds into Education Adelaide, in the past 5 years, the number of students in the city of Adelaide has hardly changed. International students, we've been doing a fantastic job. They've risen from 4,000 to 9,000 since 1999. But that's masked an underlying trend where the total number of students has only edged ahead by 2,000 to 50,592. We've got to get serious about education, not just in the state, but especially in the city. This is why we're doing everything we can to assist UniSA with its movement of the Underdale campus back to the city, where despite the controversy, we think it will be successful. We're also planning for our capital work sites to become on-the-job training centres for new apprentices. And if you think about the work that that council does, our huge capital works projects, to my mind, it doesn't matter if they take a little bit longer or they cost a little bit more if we're training an enormous number of young people in those apprenticeships that they find it so difficult to get at the moment. And our first pilot project in that will be the restoration of the Heritage Grandstand in Victoria Park, into which we'll pump about $3 million of ratepayers' funds over the next 5 years. You all right with that, Mark? I've only got commitment for the first year so far, but I don't intend to give up. And I would hope that we can get the private education providers together the way we did get the retailers together, perhaps to do a private education summit, to put together a real growth plan for the hairdressing schools and the computer schools. I mean, it's a tragedy what's happened to Pride Business College. And yet I suspect that officially nobody cares. I don't know what's going on there. I don't know to what extent the government knows. But to me, it's really important that we make those private providers successful, that we make the vet sector successful, and we make the university sector successful. So to that end, I intend to lobby the federal government for more funded places for our university. To me, it's madness at a time when South Australia perhaps is struggling in our educational sector that the federal government should reduce the number of funded places here. I think the thing to do is to start pumping the money into education. If you look at the cost of creating a new engineer, it costs the community perhaps $150,000, but capitalised up, the value of a new engineer to our community is something like $5 or $6 million. It's a very simple no-brainer on the arithmetic. And I'll soon be launching our Destination Adelaide Pastoral Care Program. I'm going to Mount Gambier to launch this, and it's a program aimed at supporting young people from rural and interstate areas during their transition to Adelaide to continue their studies. I'm acutely aware that many country people are literally afraid to send their children to the big smoke. Or if they do have the courage, they're sending them to Melbourne. I think it's important that we actually get out there and say to the mums and dads, do have the confidence to send your children to the city. We will look after them. We will care for them. And it will be worth your while. Next slide, please. Excitement. Interestingly, our studies now tell us that over 90% of the visitors under 30 are actually in the city to shop. I think the figure for all of the population is something like 82%, but it's pretty compelling. And in the nick of time, I guess, our retail summit will produce the city's first ever retail strategy, and it'll be presented to council. The government, as you know, has moved to deregulate shopping hours, and I think that's commendable. But it is important that we're actually strapped up and ready to go to make sure that we maintain our market share. There are over 2,000 retailers in the city, the biggest conglomeration in any one area in the state. But it is a little bit less than 10 years ago. They represent something like 17% of the city's total employment. And the message from last month's retail summit was clear. If we want to make retail in the city grow, we must make shopping in the city more accessible. We were told clearly that we must rejig the way we run our council car parks so that they really work for shoppers and visitors. Thus, we need to move away from providing all-day car parking for commuters, which is not good for the public transport system, and start making those parking spaces easily accessible for shoppers. The retail SAP strategy, I would hope, will see our new parks refocus on visitors away from commuters, support public transport, and unlock large, affordable capacity for shoppers. We've also just started working with the private providers, car park providers, to look at opportunities to coordinate information flow to shoppers of available spaces and special deals so that we start using the existing resources of the city much better. We've recently tested a free park and ride service during the bus strike, and we'll roll that out again tomorrow for the next interruption during the show, and we may look at making this a more regular service. Rundle Mall's long been a cornerstone of retail activity in Adelaide, and we need to work to retain that prime position as shopping hours change across the city. So we'll be rolling out soon a new master plan for the mall that, wait for it, won't involve repaving the mall. We've done that a few times lately. But rather we'll look at creating a better environment in the mall, bringing as quickly as we can on-mall dining, entertainment in the mall. I would hope to actually see a children's playground in the mall. We need to start getting nighttime activity there. And the central market we would see complemented by a series of city summer markets, a summer market circuit to make alfresco shopping and dining a daily experience around the city. Can you imagine a gaslight market in the mall, a Sunday market in Chinatown, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday and Saturday at the central market, and perhaps another day in the East End? We'll be spending $1.4 million this year, over the next 2 years, upgrading Moonta Street to make a Chinatown market work, to make an even more inviting tourist attraction. People at the retail summit also said they wanted better integration of city marketing. We actually spend a lot of money on marketing the city. We've got the swimming pool, the Rundle Mall, the Central Market, our car parks, the council itself. What people have told us is they want to see an integrated marketing plan to really promote, as a group, the benefits of the city. And if we roll all of those dollars together, there's a lot of money to effectively promote the city of Adelaide. We've also worked through the Capital City Committee on producing this new Adelaide Is marketing guide. And if you haven't seen it, I think we've tried to distribute some copies today. This guide, I would encourage all of you to get one. And what we would hope to see is that when you talk about the city, write about the city, or illustrate the city, that you make sure that we're all singing from the same song sheet so that we do pick out the things about Adelaide that make it attractive to young people. And all of the slides that I've used today are actually from the CD that's in the back of that marketing guide. So I hope you like the pictures that we're using, like the one up on the screen today, that give an image of Adelaide that is about excitement and about young people. We need live music in the city. I mean, the reality is, I think that the city is actually quite dull during the day. I would hope that we can have a program that sees regular live music in the streets and squares of the city to create this sort of vibe as a regular part of the character of the city. But if we do all of these things, you have the next slide, please. If we do all of these things, I think we can create a city that does offer accommodation, education, careers, and excitement for young people. And in doing so, offer a future for all of us. Because it's all very well to aspire to rest home South Australia. But the reality is that we can't afford it. We need a young taxation base to pay for our prostate operations and for our old age. And I don't think we want a rest home South Australia either. I mean, I know that I don't want to sit at cafes alongside other people just as boring as me. I love to sit at cafes overhearing the conversation and the excitement of young people as they talk about their relationships. And young people give us hope, and they give hope to a city, because young people are looking forward, and by their very being and their growing, they create hope. and it's a hope that we can all share. And I think whether we feel good about ourselves or good in our lives is largely about the hope that we have, how we feel about tomorrow. If we feel that tomorrow is getting better, then we put up with the cracks in the paving in Rundle Mall. I mean, if you go to Sydney and look at the paving in the Pitt Street Mall, it's a lot worse than the paving in the Rundle Mall. It's just that the people in Sydney don't spend their time inspecting every block of the Adelaide Granite in the Pitt Street Mall, because they're going somewhere. But finally, excitement is the thing. The city is the thing. Everybody says to me, oh, look, Mike, the thing is, Adelaide needs an icon. And I think, what, you know, a big banana, a big crayfish? My answer, I'm afraid, is that Adelaide is the icon. That Colonel Light has given us the icon. The best designed city in the world. This dense but permeable city sitting in the middle of a great park. Adelaide, a city in a park. If we polish this jewel, it can become one of the small but great cities of the 21st century and offer a future for our children. Thank you.
And now questions from the media. I'd ask you please to give your name and the organisation you represent, and to talk. What you have to do is, except for ex-jury, you have to stand and the microphone will miraculously come to you.
Thank you. Is that going? Rex Jury, the advertiser. I'm one of the octogenarians, the ancient people who live in the city. I love it. But, as a criticism, it's very dark. There are huge areas of shadow, yeah, which make movement around, pedestrian movement around the city, almost prohibitive and certainly frightening. Second, are you doing anything about that? Secondly, am I the only person that thinks that having the railway station at Mile End is a stupid idea, or if I'm not, are there any movements to bring it into the city? Thirdly, could you tell us your best and worst moments in your first 100 days?
Okay. All right, easy ones first. Lighting. Going around door knocking during the election, or two election campaigns, and people don't care which part of the government you're running for. They're interested in their problems. The first thing that people said to me was, for goodness sake, fix the street lighting. My street is too dark. I think that a couple of things have happened. One, that we haven't put the money in that we need to in terms of asset maintenance. But also, two others, a lot of street trees have been planted, and there has been a sort of conservatism about street lighting that perhaps it wasn't quite the right thing environmentally. The reality is that the trees have now grown, so if you're going to light your street successfully, you probably have to trim the canopy a bit higher, and when you install new lights, install your lights a bit lower. And you'll notice that pedestrian lights in the city are a lot lower than they used to be, so that you get that light under the canopy. And in terms of use of resources in a green age, we have to start recognising the intrinsic environmental value of a city. If you actually get a lot of people living close together sharing resources, that's far more efficient than trying to light suburban streets and do all the other things that you have to do to make a suburb run. It's actually very efficient to have Rex and all of his mates closely congregated under one very good street light than it is to have them sort of spread out from here to Crystal Brook. So I'm with you on that one, Rex, and so is the council, and I would hope so is the whole Green City movement. On Keswick, there's been a lot of talk about perhaps moving the bus station down to Keswick to keep it company, but I think that would be throwing good money after bad. I think we ought to bite the bullet and work out how we can bring those interstate trains back to the Adelaide Railway Station. Maybe it's something like we break them in half and bring them into the existing platforms. I'm not actually the Minister for Transport, but certainly the mood at Council is that we would love to have them in. It's not always, in terms of goods handling, the most efficient thing to do, but creating a city is more about traffic, more than about traffic management. It's also about creating a vibe and a density of use. And so we would be right behind a bringing of the interstate trains back to the city of Adelaide. Best and worst moments, goodness. I think the best moment's probably being here today, Rex, because Grant Rowlands has been telling me, look, you've got to take this speech seriously for about 3 months now. And it has been worrying me. So when I head off to Meals on Wheels to present their annual awards in about 15 minutes' time, I'm going to be feeling light as a feather. So this is probably one of my best moments. I think the worst moment was probably the, if not the night of the count, but the swearing-in ceremony where I say literally, you know, there I was being sworn in and someone shoved a microphone under my nose and said, why are you kicking these people out of the parklands? And I suddenly started to feel sorry for all people in government office and realised that it really is true that you're kind of a captive of the environment and you're held responsible for absolutely everything, and you can't get up there and say, it wasn't me. You have to actually defend your administration, who, you know, I do believe do everything with a good heart and with the best of intentions, but you're right there at the pointy end, and it's damn uncomfortable when you're not used to it.
And Mr. Hardison, Andrew Huff from the Advertiser. In your speech, you were talking a lot about new development and apartments and trying to get people into the city. A two-prong question. Firstly, are you concerned about the property bubble and the fact that it's very close to bursting? And how does then your vision work for trying to get affordable housing with it being so unaffordable at the moment? And do you think that this will affect this vision of yours of trying to get people living in the city?
Yeah, good question. Thank you for asking it. When you see our residential and other surveys come out, hopefully it'll start to change your view. Regrettably, most of the conventional wisdom, I think, around town is based on Eastern States figures. If you look at, I think, is it the ANZ or the Property Council figures, South Australian housing is still about 20% below fair value. Fair value being a calculation a bit similar to underlying value in a share price, whether it's backed by earnings and assets, in terms of average earned income and the value of the service provided. Housing in South Australia is still significantly underpriced and probably has another 20% to go. So I don't think we are anywhere near having the bubble burst. In terms of affordability, I think the best driver for our increase in population is to start to tap into the strong unsatisfied demand that's existed in Adelaide since the Playford era, and that's the affordable rental market. We have an affordable rental vacancy rate of around 1 or 2%, which I would say probably translates to 15 or 20,000 dwellings across 15 or 20,000 dwellings that don't exist across the greater metropolitan area. I think there's no reason why 10,000 of those dwellings shouldn't be new dwellings within the CBD. So I think there's still enormous demand. You go and talk to people in the public housing sector. I mean, they will tell you it's an absolute crisis, the shortage of affordable rental housing. And it's been that way in South Australia for a very long time.
Well, that then leads to a lot of housing in the CBD is perhaps out of reach of these people.
Yep.
How do you propose to make it affordable for them?
What I want the council to do is start setting an example with affordable rental housing schemes. There are a few sort of elements that need to be put in place that haven't been done before. One are is the patient capital of the end owner of it, and also the vehicle of good rental housing management. But you're really talking about getting back to the Playford era when Playford built housing for young workers. Playford did that in an interest rate climate very similar to the climate we have today. You remember those days, 5 or 6% interest, exactly what we had now. And Playford built housing and had a positive cash flow out of it. You can build housing, affordable rental housing now and have a positive cash flow. It's just a matter of deciding that's what you're going to do, it's your responsibility and getting on with it.
Louise Tricassi from the Advertiser. Michael, just a few questions. One of your big election promises was to rid the council of its infighting. Do you think you've actually achieved that?
Yes, I do.
How do you think that has happened?
Oh, because I'm nice to them.
I think that was glib of me. I think the important thing is to accept that that nobody comes to work to do a bad job. Everybody, I think, you know, generally comes to work to try and do their best and be a success. And what you need to do is find the talents in everybody and give them an opportunity to shine. I mean, I guess cards on the table. You know, probably Judith Bryan was probably my most active, intelligent opponent. And I think that Judith Bryan's contribution to the city is enormous. In my view, she is the brains behind our new development plan. I've always said that to Judith. I've said, when I come in, I want you to chair that special committee to drive that development plan because I can't do it myself. I don't have the time, and I don't have your brains or your expertise in that area. And Judith, to her enormous credit, you know, despite our political differences, has valued that support, and she's doing the job, and I really hope that we will see very soon, as I say, the best reform of the City of Adelaide Development Plan that we've seen for a very, very long time. And there are other councillors with different talents, and the trick for me is to find the things that will allow them to self-actualise and fulfil the purpose that they've come to council for. And it goes to the staff too. I mean, no one turns up to do a bad job. You know, Grant, despite having put out press releases bashing me over the head for years, is a darn good professional. And he's working even harder for me now. And I hope we're all having a good time, and the rest of the general management too. That's good. and it's important that I try and control the council so that the council don't have a go at the staff. And so at the beginning of each briefing, I try and sort of set out the landscape from the council's point of view so that the councillors have some idea of where they might go on the issue, and then wrap it up at the end with some constructive feedback from the council so that the councillors don't feel dispossessed and we end up with this tension between council and the administration. But hey, it's not easy. I mean, people don't appreciate that the councillors are all elected in opposition to each other. It's a bit like a Senate election. Inevitably, you will get this difference of views because it's a preferential voting system. And the public out there say, oh, why can't you be united as a council? You could just as easily say to the Labor and Liberal Party, you know, why can't you fellas be united as a parliament? Why are one half of you in opposition? It's not easy to fix. Mike Rand's doing a pretty good job at, you know, getting those connections going across the floor, but it's not easy. But that's the job, and I'm doing my best.
Just a few more, Michael. You've also made a lot of other pre-election promises. How far do you think you've come in achieving those?
Goodness. I regret to say that I don't have the checklist. Election promises I made were things like the economic summit, which was sort of halfway to with the retail summit. I said I'd keep Victoria Square open. We've done that. I said I'd protect the 30% tenancy mix in the central market. We've done that. I said I'd maintain the residential rate concessions. I've done that, although most people don't understand the mechanism of the 10.3 residential rate and the 30% concession, but we've done that. I've stopped the ballooning debt. I've done that. We're working on street lighting. We're putting a lot more money into street lighting. I'd like to see more go in there, but we sort of had to get the budget just passed in the short term. I've formed the Park Lands Committee, as I promised. That's about all I can think of at the moment. I've missed one. Please.
It's almost time. Is there one last penetrating wise question from somewhere?
Well, I can't say that it's going to be penetrating or wise. Maria Moscarito from the Advertiser here. 100 days is a bit of an arbitrary time frame, but I'm just wondering what you might like to cement for the city within the next 100 days as a Christmas gift for the city.
The retail strategy is terribly important for the next 100 days. Getting into Christmas, you know, I really want to see the city sparkle so that there is a real sense of excitement in the city for Christmas, that we've got that retail strategy right. And I would hope within 30 days we'll have that up and running as the full deregulation of shopping hours comes. And that will include, I would hope, the mall dining and so on by Christmas, and the, you know, summer market circuit and so on. But we'd hope to see the new development plan starting to roll out. We would hope to have accepted the final tenders on the Balfour's sites and the Franklin Street site. We'd hope to have finalised the plans for improving the central market and so on.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
We're talking about a city of knowledge, people, hope and excitement. Please accept on our behalf a magnum of St Hugo's Cabernet. If you don't want it, okay.
No, I'm impressed.
Thank you very much indeed. Michael, very nice.
Thank you. I'll get you the help now. Why don't we do that? We'll save a little bit of time because we are running a little bit past time, but of course there is a very, very important thing that has to happen before we can all go. That is the drawing of the raffle prizes, and we'll get Don to do that. He's just having a quiet glass of wine, but he can move over. Here it is. First one, the Telstra cordless phone, courtesy of Telstra, and thank you very much for doing that.
It's an orange A13 Stuart. It's an insider.
An insider. Go for number two. Okay, this is the Magnum of McGuigan Black Label Merlot, courtesy of Robert Main. Thank you, Robert.
This is a red one, A69 M Parkinson or Parkman or Portland?
A69 M
Parkwin?
Patkin? Parkin?
Well, the bottle's gone, isn't it?
It's gone. Try for the next one. This is a carton of beer from South Australian Brewing.
It's a black one, F12, no name.
F12.
Oh, there it is.
We've got it. The two tickets to the Royal Show, we'll do that first. Wow. Okay, well, four lots. Tickets to the Royal Show, courtesy of Francine Connor from the Show Society.
Unnamed, a lot of unnamed people here today. A68.
Red A68. Definitely red.
Don't worry, Judy, I'll pull one out for you pretty soon. red 68. Draw again. Red 68 comes from now we've got a purple.
Susan C. It says.
I don't know what you want. Okay, she's won.
We're still going on tickets to the Royal Show, I do believe.
Okay. Another. This is orange A18. Grant Rowland. The Grant. An orange A57. Seahawker.
Orange. Yeah.
What am I going for now?
We're still going to the show.
Neville Wilson, F46, is going to the show. If he
black F46. Black F46. Now we go to the macadamia chocolates with a bottle of Jacob's Creek Cabernet Sauvignon.
A47, Michael Weiner?
Purple A47.
Oh.
Susan C. again. I'll put that one back. An orange A9. Megan Gray, is it?
Megan Gray.
The thing's rigged, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Here's better.
Well, that's it. That's been drawn. That's for us later.
We're finished. So remember, I won't tell you who that one was. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, and thank you everyone for being here on behalf of the South Australian Press Club. And we do have further functions coming up during the year, so please stay in touch and look at your mail as it comes in and book those press club lunches. Thank you very much.